Welcome. Bodhicitta is the topic arising this year, this fall. Bodhicitta, the mind, the thought, the aspiration, the intention. To free all beings from wherever they're stuck, causing suffering and discontent, and to do this in this particular way of being a Buddha, realizing awakening. And we've been talking about this some already, but just to review a little bit, because the more I contemplate this, the more there are difficult points, I think, points that are easy to miss and skip over. And when I'm talking with people about this, it's very helpful, because they'll say, wait a second. And then I'll have to say, wait a second, too. We'll have to look deeper. So, this is my understanding of what the tradition is saying about this bodhicitta from olden times to the present. Is it's kind of like, maybe to present it a little bit like step by step. Because just to say it like that, aspiration, we might understand it, but it feels vague and maybe impossible. If not vague, at least impossible. So my understanding is that first of all, there's this recognition of suffering, recognition of discontent in this world of sentient beings. Sentient beings think that they have problems. I do. I imagine you do sometimes. You think that we actually have these problems, and that's kind of one way of calling it, you know, saying what is this discontent? There's something not right. So I think that the whole like Buddha Dharma comes out of this very practical issue of relieving this discontent. It offers these methods and practices and a path to relieve discontent. I think if we don't agree that it's, if we say discontent in others especially is fine, just let beings suffer and be discontent, then I think we can't even go on in the discussion. And we might be at that point. Sometimes I could kind of see it that way. Well, it's just the way things are. Like maybe it's not that hard to see it that way. It's just, there will always be, always has been discontent, and there always will be. Sometimes when I talk to my parents about my path, it's all about this, you know, suffering and the end of suffering, discontent and the end of discontent. Isn't that amazing that one could, you know, put one's whole life into that? And like, and they sometimes just think to me like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know you were unhappy. I thought you were a happy kid. I'm like, no, you don't understand. There's like layers and layers of this, you know, of discontent, and it's like, well, of course, isn't that part of life? Can't you just accept that and make the best of it? And, you know, fight with people when you need to and then get over it and then die. They didn't put it exactly like this. But so I think many people, maybe who don't come to this path, actually think that way. I think if it is like, well, it's fine, I'm willing to just have these problems and like make do and patch things up as best as I can and then die and have as good a life as I can. I think then maybe it's like the end of conversation, actually. I think it doesn't really, it can't really go on from there. That's, at least with my parents, sometimes say, okay, well then I just try to love them completely with that in mind. But for those of us who come here, we might not be satisfied with that. I don't know. Maybe we come for other reasons too, right? But for myself, I know it's like, I think that's, I'm not really willing to just go through this life like that and then and leave it at that. I think there's something more to understand here and be really free in the midst of whatever is this thing we call life. So if we start with this premise that, and I think before the Bodhisattva path came, it was about like looking at one's own discontent and relieving that. And it's very kind of like, it's the path of self-liberation. That's part of all the teachings of the Buddha are offering practices for the self-liberation. But then this Mahayana Bodhisattva path picked up on this other point, right? That actually we can't really be completely free and happy and completely at ease if others are still suffering. Like that insight, which, you know, maybe was floating around in the early teachings, but it wasn't really brought out fully. It wasn't really like taken up as like, wow, this is actually a major issue. I think that's what you could say kind of defines the Mahayana path. I think that's one of the main shifts. The Dalai Lama said something like that. He's like, if you recognize that you can't be really completely happy and free unless all beings are happy and free. If you just recognize that point, you basically, that's entering the Mahayana path. And if you don't recognize that, you can still practice the foundational vehicle path. It's a nice, simple way to put it. It's kind of a big thing and a kind of troublesome thing. If it were only so easy that I could just work on this one's happiness and that would be enough. But once we see that actually it's a bigger picture than that, then it becomes maha. It becomes a maha path, the great yana, the mahayana. So we recognize the discontent, suffering in others, and we want to relieve that. If we have to really come to see that, and that's already a huge step, because there's some people that we're close to that we already feel this way, probably close family or whatever. So I really, really feel this deep in my heart. I really want them to be free. It's just as important as my own happiness. But as the relationships get more and more distant, we feel it less and less. So my understanding of actual bodhicitta is we have to like somehow develop this feeling of closeness with eventually all sentient beings throughout the universe, and care about whether they suffer or not. So that's already huge. Maybe we should even say, talk about anything more than that, because that might take a long, long time to develop that kind of closeness, feeling of closeness. And there's practices, of course, that we can do. we can contemplate to open to this closeness, like the way that many people have helped us. The classic way, you've probably heard this, is if you take up the view of rebirth, this is kind of a big issue, but seems to be the kind of classic way of developing this closeness in the tradition, where it was almost like a given that people believe there's many lifetimes, and it's kind of a stream of cause and effect and karmic consciousness migrates from life to life. In that view, I think it is quite a bit easier, because then you say, we in this beginningless time, from beginningless time, we've had every possible kind of relationship with everybody. So if you see a random homeless person on the street, they have inevitably been our mother and like given birth to us and nurtured us and taken good care of us a long time ago. So I think that if you go for the rebirth view, it's quite nice, because you can bring that part in pretty easily. And you still have to stop and think about it, but it's pretty quick. Quickly becomes a conclusion that, wow, we've had these relationships, these very intimate, close relationships with every living being. You know, maybe many times they've been our mother and close friends, you know, animals included and all. This is the traditional view. I think it's hard for me sometimes to take on that view completely. So then it makes it harder to develop this sense of closeness. If everyone hasn't been our mother, then we have to maybe work a little harder. But we're really connected, and that's maybe through our practice in general. Zazen practice, being present, meeting people in an open way, we do start to feel more connected naturally, and then we do care more about their suffering. So the tradition would be like, we have this kind of equal care towards all beings and their suffering, and we want to relieve it. So that's just the beginning. Alrighty, of course, tall order. And then the next step would be like, and I think this is one that maybe sometimes gets skipped over when we're talking about it, is actually really understanding how this suffering comes to be. What is this discontent? Because if we, without the Dharma teachings about that, then we just say, well, they're suffering because they don't have the toy that they wanted. So we just give them the toy, and then we'll be done. We'll have relieved their suffering. So we have to really see that. Maybe we do give them the toy, but then we come to see that their contentment doesn't last that long with the toy. They get bored with it pretty quick, and it seems like the discontent is, according to the Buddha, based on this like fundamental ignorance, the illusion of separation and the belief in the independent self. Many ways we could talk about the origins of suffering. But I think for my understanding of classic view, bodhicitta can't really come to be without actually not only wanting to relieve this discontent, but understanding how it would be relieved. Right? It's like, if we could just give like infinite toys to everyone, then maybe that would be easier. Sounds like it might be hard, but actually I think it might be easier than to actually somehow find a way to help all these beings discover the root of suffering, discover this misconception that lies at the root. That's, I think, harder than giving a billion toys. So therefore, again, bodhicitta becomes, wow, this is This is a big thing. We have to help that way. And that's why it is said we have to realize this awakening. We have to be a Buddha that deeply understands not only how suffering comes to be, but how it comes to be in a kind of somewhat unique way in each different being. Yeah, so that's like the skillful means part. It's not just a generic, I will teach like everybody the Four Noble Truths. In fact, I'll just like put it on one piece of paper and I'll just make a billion copies and then that'll be done. I don't think it works that way. That would be nice too, if it were that simple. So thinking of these four Bodhisattva vows that we chant at the end of the talk, kind of see these steps as kind of relating to that. First, there's like, just beings are numberless. I vow to find a way to free them from suffering. That's what save means in this case. I'll emancipate, liberate from this discontent and this bondage of misconception. So first it's that, but that's not the whole story. If it were just, I vow to save all beings, I don't know how, well, then the next vow is how. Well, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Both my own, to realize clarity that can help others, and I vow to end the other beings' illusions, because that's actually the root of their suffering. So I kind of see it almost like a progression there. And then, okay, so the next, the third vow is, well, how do we remove, how do we end infinite delusions? Well, there's these many dharma gates, these many practices and paths to enter in this work. So, dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. And then, let's say, if we really have entered them with the original vow to save all beings, then that is actually becoming Buddha's way, unsurpassable Buddha's way. But always keep being based on the first, vowing to free all beings from suffering. We vow to be a Buddha. So I think the key thing there is like, this is why it's a step beyond kindness and compassion. Kindness and compassion are the great ways to start cultivating this bodhicitta and this openness to others and their suffering. Big steps, necessary, important steps. And then it's more than just compassion. Now it's like this vow, it's this intention, it's this wish to free all beings, and we see that the only way, according to this tradition, the only way to really free all beings is to deeply understand how freedom comes to be. And then finding ways to help beings to be free of the root of suffering. And along the way, of course, we can give many toys and we can give many pages of the Four Noble Truths and other many things that will help open beings. But seen in this way, it's like kind of immense project, immense vow, immense aspiration, but possible. Oh yeah, another step I would add in actually is that is coming to understand the Dharma enough so that we actually believe, actually have faith and trust that this path really does lead to the relief of discontent. I think that's actually a huge piece. Because if you just say, well, I've heard Buddha sounds really great and like, I guess he's just got like infinite power and wisdom and omniscience to help, so let's just be that. I think that doesn't work either. It won't really be sustainable. We have to see, no, I really understand how it's possible. And I think our understanding comes from clarifying the teachings more and more deeply and tasting them. And I think actually we all have a little taste of them or we wouldn't be here. Yeah? We see how the various aspects of this practice really do relieve discontent in ourselves. We can see that much. We might not say, I don't know if it'll relieve all discontent. I see it works somewhat. But we can deepen our faith through our own experience and through clarifying the teachings again and again and kind of testing them and reasoning with them. So that it's possible to be a Buddha, and that it's possible even for anyone. So this path is open to anyone to realize this way things are. Anyone, including us. I admit, sometimes I get stuck there. Like I really see how it's theoretically possible, but like I kind of, sometimes I feel like, but my, you know, particular karmic obscurations in this body and mind, in this life, at least in this life, I don't know. I don't know. It sounds almost too awesome. But can I vow anyway? I think, well, there's nothing else more worthwhile. Even if I can't, the more I see it, the more I see it. Almost anything else is somewhat meaningless in relation to this possibility. So I'm willing to try. But I've heard also that the two of the main obstacles to deepening our understanding and practice are kind of interesting, like almost two opposites. One is pride, which is like that I already know enough. I already got it. I got the Dharma, I've heard it a million times, and I'm already doing it, and let's just keep doing it. Like there's maybe a kind of underlying pride, like, this is enough. And then the other side is discouragement, like, like it's too much, I can't do it. So it's maybe like overly inflated self-esteem and one's like overly deflated self-esteem. I've already done it, or it's like I kind of got it down. And it's like, oh no, it's just way too much. And I think we can veer back and forth between these two pretty easily, right? So there's some middle way between them. You know, we're just open to going beyond our current understanding and willing to keep going, even if we're discouraged. And if our motivation and devotion starts to waver, I think if we keep coming back to the very original point with this bodhicitta thing, I think that's really for me, I find that the kind of trigger is like, but there's actually beings are really suffering, you know. If it's just me, I can say, well, I don't even matter. This may be a common thing, right? Like, I'll just make it through this life and then die and then that's that. But actually, there's many other beings here who need this help. And I kind of see that this help, I can see there's some things that could really help. And maybe we have found some of the things that those of us who have come to practice, we do know some things that maybe could help. So we already have this head start. We kind of have this advantage. It's kind of like it would almost be irresponsible if we've come this far in practice and then don't use our practice to benefit others. Then it'd be more irresponsible than if we didn't know about practice. It's like that's fine, right? That's an easy excuse. as many, many questions arise along the way. Like today, some Jehovah's Witnesses came to my door. Did I mention this in a previous talk? I mentioned to some people anyway, about a month ago. There's the same people. And one of the same people with somebody else. Yeah. I've been Jehovah's Witness for like 40 years in Santa Cruz. And he's like, Kokyo, right? Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name. I think already when I recognized him, I already felt like some tension. Well, the first time they came a month ago, I thought, oh, this is interesting. How often do you get to meet the Jehovah's Witnesses and have some interfaith dialogue? I was up for it a month ago, and we did some talking. We did some little debates and stuff. And maybe they had enough fun that they're like, he said, I remember we had a nice conversation last time, so I thought we'd come by about every month. Yeah. I think last time I maybe did say what we were doing, and it was nice last time Patrick and the gang were cooking for the homeless garden in the kitchen, and that smells good. I'm like, yeah, this Zen Center of cooking for the shelter and the garden, and I think they appreciated that. And anyway, they immediately, pull out the Bible and, do you know about where Satan came from? and part of my discomfort was like, it was hard to have a kind of like balanced conversation because they didn't seem that interested in like my views. A little bit. But there was a little tension. But then I invited them in. I'm like, well, we're just standing here. Come sit down. Here's my understanding of Satan, actually, is basically it's fundamental ignorance. That it's actually, here's what he's saying. Satan's a creature out there that's creating all this problem and all this mythology of like coming down to earth and doing something. Well, wait. I think some of this is maybe like metaphor, because even in our Buddhist scriptures, we say we have scriptures too, but we say none of it is like definitive teaching, except this is part of the Buddhist like religion. Is that the definitive scriptures are the ones that teach emptiness, which means like that none of this is what the words are saying anyway. Kind of a nice thing. We have these definitive scriptures, but they just say everything that we're saying is empty. And all the other ones that say anything other than that are not definitive. It's kind of a nice part of our tradition. It was this thing of like these scriptures are like not the work of humans. Like the humans wrote it down, but it's direct word of God. And a lot of our discussion was about like validity of scripture, and Buddhism has these debates too, actually. I mean, there's you can have a valid reasoning of some dharmic point based on valid scripture. Even in Buddhism, it has this thing, but it's tricky. It's got to be the ultimate teachings. It seems like everything in there is like the valid scriptural teaching. And so I felt like part of the disconnect here was that, and I bring this up, and it's still connected to this bodhicitta issue, right? But was like we weren't quite meeting because he kept going back to, well, but it says here, and I kept saying, don't tell me, just tell me what you say. Like, because, and maybe most of the people they're talking to are Christians that maybe feel like, well, we have to believe everything in the Bible, so then that's going to work for us. Quoting scripture will convince us, because anything in there is reality. I'm like, I think for me, you know, I'm a Buddhist priest. I'm like, I know. They're like, I know. So I think this scripture is not going to be the defining thing. I think for your skillful means, I think just quoting the scripture is maybe not going to work. But I mean, but what you actually think, and then he actually then opened up a little bit. It's like, I used to have a really troubled life, and I really, this really turned me around. This, you know, this religion, that's why I'm like totally hot about it. I'm like, it really helped, it changed my whole life. And I'm like, that is beautiful. That is like, we need more people just into spirituality whose lives are turned around by it. And then I felt like we connected, actually. But I say this because I think they were coming from a kind of perspective of what they might call something like bodhicitta. I think they go door to door to save all beings, right? I think it's an altruistic vow. And it's difficult. They have these like tie and jacket and hot sign. You know, like this is austere to walk around door to door like this. I offered them, yeah, like that, you know. And so I think it comes from a good place, from this wish, and then it's like, and then maybe even this, maybe our second vow. Well, what's the root of suffering? And you know, maybe they would say it's Satan, and so we got to work with Satan like this. And like the kind of second bodhisattva vow, and then dharma gates. We need lots of dharma gates, and I kind of, that's what I was kind of feeling. That's where it was sort of breaking down. Like, I need some more dharma gates. These, you know, especially some of the Old Testament stuff that was really like, it wasn't addressing liberation for me. It was addressing like, you know, the history of the world. Like, I don't really care about the history of the world. So maybe more dharma gates. Maybe they would develop some after our conversation. And ways to meet too, skillful ways to meet. Like I asked them, like, well, if I came to your door with, you know, the Heart Sutra or something, and said, please, can I just tell you a little bit about this sutra? Would you really be that open? And I said, yeah. When the Mormons come, I talk with them. This would be challenging. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, that's how it felt to me, was like a dogma. But then I think that's, we can apply that to ourselves. I just gave this traditional teaching on these kind of stages leading to bodhicitta. Yeah, so, oh, here's a teaching, and then like the Buddha said, don't believe it because it's in the scriptures. This is the Kalama Sutta. He only said this in one sutra, but it's one of his best. One of his greatest. Sutras. Y'all know about the Kalama Sutta, where the Buddha, someone's asking the Buddha some questions about, I think it's actually about good and evil, about right and wrong. And the Buddha said, don't go with the holy books. Of course, there weren't Buddhist sutras at that time. It would be like the Vedas or something. Don't go by what they say. Don't even go with what your teachers say. Kind of implying, don't even go with what I say. You can kind of like use what I say, but you have to check it out for yourself. You have to verify this for yourself. I think it's a beautiful, it's like Buddha's statement of non-dogmatism. Of course, there's other things that look like dogma in there, mixed in there too, because humans are humans. But we want something to like hold on to have faith in, it's unshakable. And And a book is pretty good, a scriptural book is pretty good because that's not my view. In fact, that was a nice challenge. He said, well, do you believe that your experience, I kept talking about direct experience. I said, you keep talking about direct experience, how do you know your experience is true? I thought that was pretty good. You know, they have this book to rely on. This is true, and we just have total faith in that. And I said, yeah, actually, you know, most of my experience, I feel like I can't really rely on. It's actually not true. But most of my experience is Satan. Yeah, I wouldn't go that far, but it's basically deluded. It's this dualistic thought, this churning of stories of the world in my life. But if we really deeply settle into Zazen, drop off body and mind, then we can taste, we can confirm verify some truth for ourselves. And how do we know that's really true? These are good questions to keep exploring. Yes. You have a point about this? Sure, bring it up. Our experience, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great story, and it, you know, I also kind of feel that within Buddha Dharma complex tradition, that the Zen tradition is maybe most about one's own experience, and that's why probably a lot of us love it. It's like maybe least dogmatic amongst Buddhist traditions in an already pretty non-dogmatic tradition. And then it can go too far the other way too. So that's why, you know, in terms of like, well, everything is it, right? So then another point just to bring up here related to all this, and after this conversation with these fellows, who were also, by the way, very big. They were like over 6 feet tall, and I thought, I wonder, that's interesting. It made me a little nervous, to be honest. It made their message strong. Or hard to debate. But this other point is I thought about lineage, you know. We have what is it to uphold and transmit a lineage within any spiritual tradition? Because it comes with all this stuff, some of which looks kind of like dogmatic or could look stuck, and yet that's the it looks like within all these different, I mean, I felt like within Christianity, the Jehovah's Witness lineage is this particular thing. And they were talking to me in a way that was like a little bit critical of some other Christian branches. They kind of said, don't tell anybody, but kind of like, I can tell you as a Buddhist. It was a little bit funny, but they, and you know, of course we can have these squabbles and you can have wars about this stuff. But the beauty, too, is that there's, like, particular ways, and, like, if there's effective ways that are freeing people from suffering, they come in, like, a particular form. And I just, you know, and then in modern times we kind of mix them together, we drop a lot of the form and things like this, and it just struck me how the beauty, actually, of particular Dharma gates. Dharma gates are boundless. I've had to enter all of them. And yet, we have particular packages that are like complete packages to liberation, you might say. And especially if they're time-tested, that's part of the lineage thing. It's like this whole package seems to have really worked for a lot of people for many centuries. But then, if it's a whole package and you start taking pieces out of it, then that's an interesting question for me. Like, then is it still effective? How many things can you take off? And this is our challenge as we Buddha Dharma comes to a new country, because we have to adapt to a new culture. But how can we, you know, which parts of the package are extraneous and which are essential? And that, it's almost maybe like some of it's trial and error. Some of it's deep contemplation of like the principles behind it. And some is like, well, let's try it. And the proof is in the pudding. Yeah. Within Buddha Dharma, you could see the bodhicitta and the awakening that the vow is based on, being Buddha, is universal across the Mahayana lineages, and yet then there's these different lineages, which Suzuki Roshi in one point said, well, what's getting transmitted here is a lid. That's an interesting image. What's transmitted from generation to generation is a lid. You could say the pot is the pot of Buddha, the pot of, or even if you go across spiritual traditions outside of Buddhism, the pot of like freedom and liberation from suffering and, you know, boundless love and compassion. That's the universal pot. And then that's like doesn't really, you know, what defines the lineage is not so much the pot, actually, as the lid on the pot, which is like the practices and the forms and the methods and the traditions and the any particular understandings of what this soup is, too. So it's the same soup, but we have different ways, the different lineages will have different ways of expressing it, and then different ways of revealing it, and different ways of eating it, and different ways of cleaning up the pot afterwards. So that's part of this bodhicitta vow, which is, can we, if we really see the suffering of all beings, we need a method to get at the root of the suffering and release this. And it looks like, so far in the history of the world, that's often been done through these like particular streams, pots with particular lids. Not to say that anyone is better than others, but they're particular packages.
When you talk about the suffering, I've been thinking about when you're teaching young children, and how would be real upset, and the way that I would try to deal with it would be to acknowledge the suffering. I see that you're really sad about this, that the uncle will be afraid of that. Not to give them what they want, not because I don't want to give it to them, because the situation.
But you know it won't really help.
It won't help, and maybe it's not even possible. But just acknowledging that perhaps helps them to
So maybe you would, I think again of Zen, in terms of all the different Buddhist lineages, maybe is most in accord with what you're saying, in the sense that there are of course a lot of teachings in Zen, but often we'll just say, just come in and sit here and look at your own experience. And you know, there's some classic Zen stories of like the reason that I respect my teacher more than anyone else is because he never told me anything. So in Zen we have stories like that. I think other Buddhist traditions they would be like, what? That, how is he's enacting his bodhisattva vow if he doesn't say anything? So something like that. We let people find their way, and with a mix of offerings and things too. Yes, Patrick. Could it be that that's how to do that? Part of it. Because sometimes he wrote about saving all beings. Like that's what we're studying these days, right?
Thank you.
Good question. But I think one way to see it is like it's just so extensive. It's not like something that you could just do in a day. Right? So it's kind of like it's first. It seems like this teaching that Bodhicitta is first. You're just really getting really grounded in this vow, and that's your intention, and that's what we're living for. And then when you're at Emmeline's feet, right? Then if that vow is there, then maybe when meeting some particular person there that's really having a hard time, maybe there's a turning word that can be offered to where they're particularly stuck at that particular point. One at a time. Yeah, it's a good point too. Mm-hmm. But I think one answer to that would be, but Lori needs saving too. And you could say, with those people more, and I think this is where, and I agree that like we should, let's take care of the most suffering first in terms of the practical things. But I think that's one thing about this. That's why I mentioned this particular point about seeing the root of suffering as this basic delusion. So, because in that way, and you could say we're all equal. Maybe some of those people are like really mentally ill, and just we might say their delusion is more than ours because we have it together. But I think in terms of this fundamental ignorance, actually we're equal. Right, so I might feel like, well, I'm happy, and they're really like upset, but like on a deeper level, like we're both equally totally trapped in samsara, and maybe if we help Lori realize complete awakening, then she can join you at Emmeline Street tomorrow after her awakening. So something like that might be one way to look, but big questions and great questions. Yeah, it's because we can also get stuck kind of self-absorbed in it, in our own little world, of course. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, with short one?
I don't know.
How about in the essence? One nugget.
Well, that's it. I know somebody who's watched you work. I know somebody who's a very good worker. And this person describes that you interact with your clients with great kindness. And so I would say that even if people aren't in the agenda, those of us who are fortunate enough to get to be here go out in the world and share whatever we have, you know, it was we received, and we share that out there. And maybe we don't know that we do that, but somebody told us. So I just, you know, I mean, in the sense of Kyoken, Kyoken is a part of why we cook, is for the ease and the joy of the assembly.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not like ultimate suffering and like the person's whole position clears up and they get a lot of money and they're going to have to, you know, the tracking that we can make that. So, yeah. But, you know, if it's giving people moments of ease in a difficult day, that's a kind of amazing.
I think the hardest one to see is if somebody's their whole life as a hermit, never sees anybody and refuses to see anybody. But even Bodhidharma was willing to let Hueka come, if he was willing to cut off his arm and stuff. Right? but even that, I think that was his. He's like, we're going to do this thing. And in fact, that was what got us here was Bodhidharma meeting this one person. I think he met a few other people too. So there's some... What's that?
Emperor Wu.
Emperor Wu, yeah.
Emperor Wu went on to really, you know, he was humble.
Yeah. But even if you never leave the Zendo, there's, of course, there's more people in here than Bodhidharma's cave. So, but I think it is an interesting point. If you're completely isolated from all sentient beings for your entire life, then we might wonder about that. Then we have to rely on magic powers.
What does that get pointed out? As always, I think if you take this metaphor for you, if you take that as a matter of skillful means, then you meet people where they are. You meet people where they are. That means if you move a religion from a tradition, a culture from Japan to America,
okay. Skillful means. Got it. Dogen says in his extensive record, the family style of all Buddhas and ancestors is to first arouse the vow to save all living beings by removing suffering and providing joy. Only this family style is inexhaustibly bright and clear. In the lofty mountains, we see the moon for a long time. As clouds clear, we first recognize the sky. Cast loose down the precipice, the moonlight shares itself within the 10,000 forms. Eihei Koroku, section 434. Even when climbing up the bird's path, taking good care of yourself is spiritual power. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of the great awakened way. Beings are numberless. I vow tis. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.